This episode of Igalia Chats is brought to you by Igalia, an open source consultancy with a proven track record of landing features in devices from XR to handheld, deep expertise with embedded devices, advancements in flagship web browsers, kernel contributions, and much more. To get in touch or to learn more, visit igalia.com.
Okay, hi. I am Brian Cardell. I'm a developer advocate at Igalia.
And I'm Eric Meyer, also a developer advocate at Igalia, and we're going to be talking about ecosystem health again, and we've invited the executive director at the OpenJS Foundation, Robin Bender-Ginn, to join us. Robin, please tell us a little bit about yourself.
Hey, I'm Robin. I always say I have the coolest job ever. I have the privilege of working on open source full-time, so yeah, work on OpenJS, which is the neutral home for JavaScript and the web.
Nice. And you get to work on open source all the time. Not many people get to do that.
I know. And, you know, it was sort of part of my day job, actually, at Microsoft back in the day when it was actually hard to do open source. But there's still a lot of volunteer work that happens, you know, if anyone's working on open source as part of their day job. It just blends over.
And Robin recently gave a talk at NodeConf that has a title so good that we had to say we need to put that as a show title and so invite Robin on to talk about the same thing, because the title is Magic Piles of Money. Could you tell us a little bit about the talk that you gave?
Yeah, I mean, there's, you know, a lot of folks will ask us a number of questions, being, you know, a foundation, and we're also affiliated with the Linux Foundation. So I think there's a misperception that we just have a magic pile of money from which to draw upon, whether at OpenJS or the LF. And actually, I was talking to some of my friends in big tech, and I think they said they have the same misperception amongst their team. So no, there are no magic piles of money, particularly with open source.
Yeah, I mean, I hear that frequently. In fact, we just were hearing this very recently with regard to recent talk about Chrome being split off from Google. People said, well, you know, you should just donate to Linux Foundation. That's not a solution. Like, I think people think if you just give it to them, then there's magic piles of money to pay the people to work on it. But is there like a universe in which you can just give something that requires, you know, maybe a billion or two a year in maintenance and development, and they'll just pick up the bill? Is that a...
I think the answer is I wish, and yes, there should be. Absolutely. But unfortunately today there's not, but I'll try my best to make a dent perhaps. Yeah.
People also think the similar about Igalia, say like, well, Igalia can maybe do it. You know, Igalia is about 150 people, and we work on three browsers and a whole bunch of other Linux stuff, you know, ranges from multimedia to graphics kernel drivers. And like, yeah, we can't pick up a whole Google.
You can't.
I mean, have you been hearing that from people saying to OpenJS or the Linux Foundation, hey, Chrome's going to be up for sale, why don't you just buy it or take it under your wing and advance it? Is that like...
Or package managers or any actually open source project. I do remind people that it's just me full-time and two half-time people. And then we have fractional employees at the Linux Foundation. So, you know, we're like essentially the product team around a development team in any traditional company. So while we do believe that when you're in a neutral organization, you will grow your developer base, we are certainly don't have magic piles of money to pay developers.
You had a statistic in here that is the Linux Foundation has 604,999 contributors. That's a lot.
That's a lot across the projects. And if the team, Jim Zemlin and team, did an analysis and they took the average salary of a developer across multiple countries around the world, and they came to $43,000 a year for the mean. So if the Linux Foundation paid every developer, all of the core maintainers working across all the projects, that would come to $26 billion a year.
Billion with a B.
Yes, which surpasses the Microsoft R&D budget back in, I think it was what, 2020? Was that my date? Which is $24 billion. So yeah, the Linux Foundation definitely does not have that resources, and nor I would think that many of our maintainers would want to work for $43,000 a year.
Yeah. Both of those numbers are just mind-boggling to me.
Yeah.
Like, they're just already so much money. Like, the fact that, like, you can say, okay, all of those developers, if they made that salary, which I agree, like, most of the developers that I work with, they're not working for that salary, which is kind of terrible in the sense that that means that there's some people being really dramatically underpaid. I don't know if some of that goes to, like, they're making zero because they're, you know, maybe early in their career and trying to do some things for free to help establish themselves or something. But even still, the fact that if you just took those developers and paid them that much money, we're talking about 26 billion and change. And then to say Microsoft had an R&D budget that was like anywhere close to that, it's just mind-boggling to me. But that it does give you this sense, though, that like if companies contributed, it feels like there's plenty of money to go around to actually pay people, right?
I mean, ideally, companies would have their employees working on open source as part of their company. If you look at OpenJS, most of our developers who work on our projects are volunteers. That's a little different than some of the other foundations, maybe in AI or CNCF, but primarily we are volunteer. We have volunteer developers. But if these folks could work on it as part of their day job and get all the benefits that go along with having a full-time job, that obviously is ideal. That still doesn't solve the problem of, you know, some of the, I call it the boring bits that, you know, open source developers don't want to do, like the infrastructure, the releases, or some of the sort of specialty things like security releases. It's really hard to get folks to work on that. You know, easier to get folks to work on the bright, you know, shiny new features.
But. Yeah. So, I mean, it seems like it's not just developers, it's project managers. You need people who are going to work on the releases and the compiling the notes and the readmes and the whatevers, which some developers love to do, but I think we've all experienced that most of them don't. They would rather just code.
Yes.
That $26 billion doesn't even cover the project managers. It just covers the developers.
It just covers the developers. And we like to say, can you imagine Linus Torvalds doing event logistics and putting on a collaborator summit? This is probably not something he wants to do, you know?
Yeah, yikes. So now we're talking a much bigger number. And it would be great if every company paid for one person at a minimum to just work on open source. And it's like, we'll pay their salary. Will they get our benefits? And ideally, Google's and Microsoft's of the world would pay more than one person. But if every company did just one person, I don't. Would we even get to where we need to be? I'm not even sure if that's. I mean,
probably
there would be a way
not.
Of distributing the cost. But are there, you know, 605,000 companies that would be able and willing to do that? Probably not. I guess.
No, probably not. And, you know, we should give a shout out to some of the companies that are doing that. You know, Bloomberg is doing that, Red Hat and IBM, Microsoft is doing that, Sentry, others, you know, Hero Devs, boy, the list goes on. I think if you look at most of our members, Capital One, they're doing that. So there's some really great companies, but there's also a lot of companies not to, you know, I'm not going to name names, but they're building, they have billion-dollar businesses where some of our projects are required to run their software. And we're not seeing a lot from a lot of companies.
But okay, but so you do have to, as part of a foundation, you do have to raise money. You have to raise money for, let's talk about what do you raise money for?
So we have about a $2.9 million budget. About 1 million of that is our corporate memberships, and we've had close to 900,000 from grants. So about 18% of that goes to our staff, which is below average. We're pretty lean. You know, a lot of nonprofits run about 25 to 50% for staff. We have PM and marketing, and then we have about 7% go to the Linux Foundation for fractional staff. They're the folks that, you know, in HR who run our benefits, all of the finance team. We process anywhere from 40 to 80 individual invoices on behalf of our projects every month, all kinds of things. And so,
what's an example of the, like, what are examples of some of those invoices that you have to pay out every month?
Some of them are like infrastructure charges. Some of those we have contributed for free. We actually have $2 million a year in infrastructure contributed for free from like Cloudflare and DigitalOcean and Fastly, which is awesome. Max Stadium. That's great. But we have a lot of others just to run the infrastructure of projects from Slack and Discord and Gmail and all those types of things. And of course, when we run, you know, events or any sort of logistics for the organization, that, you know, drives that number up quite a bit. And we pay vendors. We have legal support. Our projects rely on our legal. About half of that is trademark registration and enforcement. So when new projects come in, we want to sort of reinforce that trademark. So, you know, not just for marketing purposes, but if we want to be seen as the authentic download link. So it's really important that we enforce those trademarks.
So you said a $2.9 million budget?
Mm-hmm. Yes.
That's not very much.
No, I was doing the math in my head. If it's $26 billion just to pay all the maintainers, your budget is approximately very close to 1/10,000th of what would be needed.
And 1 million of that is new this year, close to 1 million. It's about 850 for an event. And the last 2 years, we sort of took a hiatus on events. We did some co-locations, but events are the largest kind of risk for any organization.
Yep.
And maybe outside of KubeCon, ask any event organizer if they're making money off events. It is definitely a big risk. So that's sort of skewing our budget this year with money in and hopefully money out. You know, we just had the JS Conf brand donated to us. So hopefully we'll have at least a break even year this year, but we're willing to invest a little bit.
Is fundraising part of what you do?
I do. Absolutely.
What's that like? Because in a way, Eric and I are also fundraising for the web and open source. And we have to talk to people about what Egalia does and what's your experience like? Because you're not in the same situation, but it's a little bit similar.
Sort of similar. And I think the three of us, we would have a golden Rolodex, right? We've been around for a while. We know people, but it's not easy, right? Because everyone else is raising money as well for their technology projects. And I think the number one thing I hear all the time is it's not a priority.
Yeah, totally.
Yeah, you're essentially competing against everyone else. So yeah, we hear it's not a priority. You know, there is a lot of cuts. I will, you know, credit, I think, to our members. I think we've been flat year after year. And I've been able to essentially double our budget with grants, which is kind of a new revenue stream for foundations affiliated with the Linux Foundation. Whereas I think during COVID and some of the layoffs, we did see some foundations with, you know, a good drop. But what I found most effective for fundraising is you need to have developers sort of working in our projects to sort of reinforce the importance of what they're working on and how that benefits the company. You know, that developer feedback they're getting. We always say, you know, developers, you know, features are sort of added by people doing the work. If you want a feature, it's important to you, it's important to your company, you just got to show up and do the work. So it's easy as that.
And when companies tell you it's not a priority, do they ever say what the priority is? Or is that?
They do. Often it's sort of the bright shiny pennies. It's AI and it's security.
Well, one of the two I can understand.
Yeah. And we've gotten grants from Alpha Omega, which is great. There's still a lot of money funded to OpenSSF that provides a lot of great work as well.
Yeah. And so grants, you said that that's a new revenue stream. Is that something that you have a background in, or you found someone who's good at it, or how did that happen?
Well, I do have a background. I worked on privacy and security for 7 years before starting in open source. So I understand that. But I'm also a writer. So grants are really writing intensive to get that grant application. For example, you know, the German government created the Sovereign Tech Fund for infrastructure. My grant application was 18 pages single space. So it's not easy. And the execution was hitting, you know, quarterly milestone deliverables in quite in billable hours.
It's like simultaneously so positive and also so, I don't know, tricky and frustrating, because I think we're still early in it, don't understand it enough as a species, you know, like, but Egalia has also been doing more grant related work. For us, a lot of times what we have done in the past is purely investment. Like, we think a thing needs to be done and nobody is doing it, so we just do it, you know. We invest, we pay our peers to do the work. But now, like, we get at least some of that also covered through grants, you know. So it sort of like doubles our ability to do the same investment. Like, we invest the same amount, we can do twice as much. And I guess it's like this for everything that requires grants, is like, you have to spend a lot of time trying to get the grant. And at the end of the day, you might not get the grant. And then if you do get the grant, it's great, you do the work, but there's no guarantee you can get more, right?
Yeah. The trick in getting a grant is to create a new program that you could not otherwise do without that grant. So that's really the trick. Now, the downside is they don't like to renew grants. And so what you've done is you've created a new program, which essentially is a new dependency on your organization. So if it is not renewed, then you are looking for to backfill that gap.
Yeah, it's really interesting. And then, you know, other things can interrupt it. Like, the Sovereign Tech Fund has been interrupted with recent developments in Germany. That's throwing a wrench into a lot of the things with the Sovereign Tech Fund at the moment. But
I don't want to be like Eeyore when it comes to grants, because honestly, it did help us leapfrog tremendously many key areas, I think, of our organization. Our infrastructure was a mess. We have a lot of older technologies, 15, 20-year-old technologies, where the infrastructure were like, you know, we joke about wobbly servers in somebody's closet who no longer works on the project. And it's like, eeks, you know. So we really did an archaeological dig and, you know, consolidated all the infrastructure, modernized it, and then moved it over to the Linux Foundation IT. So we could have never done that without that grant.
Yeah, I definitely don't want to be Eeyore on that either. We can double, basically, more or less, how far our own money goes by explaining why we think is important and getting like some kind of, if we get somebody to fund this half, then we can do this other stuff. So yeah, we really like it. And also we see that, you know, even governments around the world are like, the White House has put out a number of times in the past couple of years, things like parallel programming in languages like Rust are the future, you know, they must be memory safe. Parallel languages must be the future. And it's like, yeah, Rust, we do that. Servo is a project that
good one.
Sure could use funding, government. So yeah, I think I'm very positive on ways that we can get other kinds of funding that is more like the ecosystem finds a way. On that note, I have a question. Like, the Linux Foundation, is it founded, headquartered in the US?
It is. It is headquartered in the US.
And so it's a nonprofit, but is a 501c3?
It's a 501c6.
C6. Yeah. So that means that you can't like write off donations to it, right?
Correct.
That's a thing that I've heard a number of times would really help incentivize businesses to give. Have you heard that as well?
No, to be honest. And actually, OpenJS, however, is independently incorporated. We're one of three projects at the LF, so we have a master service agreement. So the LF does have a charity, you know, a 501c3. I've heard if you want to apply for a 501c3 today, I've heard from our attorneys, it's about a 18 to 24 month wait, but they do have that set up at the LF. You know, I sort of hear the opposite. You know, we have a sustainability collaboration space, which are our working groups at OpenJS, and people are bouncing around. Should we have a for-profit? What should we think about? And we started thinking about it a little bit with our ecosystem partner program, where HeroDevs is the first partner. And HeroDevs is giving us a revenue share up from their enterprise customers if we co-market with them. And so that was a really interesting challenge with our attorneys and tax attorneys and nonprofit attorneys. We came to understand that because this is helping the broader ecosystem on the code that's already been put to bed, we're fine with our 501c6. However, if we bring in too much revenue, we may have to spin off a for-profit. So kind of pushing the boundaries, I think, of open source a little bit, but, you know.
Yeah, I like it, though. I mean, I think we need to figure out ways to push the boundaries because they're currently, you know, kind of running up against the limits of it. Maybe, honestly, running a little bit on borrowed time in a few ways.
And a 501c6, what is a
C6? It's like think about like an industry trade organization. It's just a little different.
Okay.
So
this might be a little bit spicy, but it seems to me that there's an attitude in open source that if you're not volunteering, you're not doing it for the right reasons. Like you should be giving your labor for free, essentially. And people who want to get paid are, to use a term from my youth, sellouts. Is that something that you encounter, and is it a source of friction in trying to make all this sort of thing happen?
It's not something I've experienced or seen. I think because, again, we're primarily volunteer-led. I also think kind of the newer generations are pretty, you know, solid with their work-life balance, and they are doing it out of passion. The big problem with that sort of model on volunteering is it really hurts women to enter open source projects. And the Linux Foundation did some research on diversity, and time was the biggest blocker because, unfortunately, still women, you know, you could have a great career, but you're still coming home and they still take on the majority share often of household chores, childcare, and things like that. So if you're, you know, taking that approach, then that does not help our cause.
Yeah. And I don't know if you looked at, you know, people from underserved populations or marginalized populations, it also tends to exclude them because they don't necessarily have the economic resources to just, I'm going to give 10 hours of my week to maintaining this software package or contributing to the software package because they are trying to get by.
Yeah.
When we talked about a lot of developers wouldn't work for $43,000 a year, I mean, in some countries, that is not much above what is now considered the poverty line.
Right.
So,
yeah, and don't you think open source is just mainstream now, right? And so because it is, and every company is using it, it should just be normalized within your day job.
You're saying contributing to it.
Contributing, yeah.
Contributing to it, like, so I can tell you that for me, you know, I was, you know, doing contributions to open source when I was working for previous companies. And for them, they had no problem using it. But for you to participate, you know, you sign agreements when you work there that say that, you know, you kind of can't without special permission. And I think a lot of developers don't try to get it, and those who do, it winds up being difficult because maybe they're the first ones at their company, and you have to involve the legal teams. And I don't know, for me, I think it at a few companies like drew attention to like, gee, what is that guy doing? Do you know what I mean? Like,
yeah,
like we have to pay lawyers special to deal with this guy. I mean, it all worked out in the end, but I do think that like I can see a lot of situations that are discouraging for people wanting to do it at a lot of companies. So like it would be great if it could be normalized. And it's been a minute since I worked in a corporation, but at least when I did, that was my experience. And
yeah, I heard from OSPO, Open Source Programs Office Leader of a financial organization a couple of weeks ago, that it takes 2 months to get a PR, a pull request, open at their company. So, which is far different from another, you know, for example, say Capital One, who's one of our members, who's very, has a great innovative OSPO program. So hopefully, you know, sort of the industry will help bring others along. But you're right, it's a challenge.
So like, I've had a unique opportunity, like the way that I've interacted with open source and corporations and like the different corporations that I've been able to work with. And I think for a lot of companies, it would be easier to somehow give money. So there's like very clear delineation of like, that's your thing and we use it. And I like the ideas that we're talking about, like how you would fund that, both government and like for-profit models. You know, the like the for-profit thing, the interesting thing about this to me is that, you know, both of them are just really trying to say, well, nobody wants to pay for the boring stuff. It's the roads and the bridges and the, you know, it's the stuff that we all use to make the stuff that people really want. But people will pay for the stuff they really want, generally. We just need a way to subsidize it, to place some kind of levy. And like the amount of money that is generated through these projects and the amount of products and things that enables us to build, like, all of it is funded by, you know, a tiny, tiny, tiny fraction of that. So it's, I think it's just finding like a better way to structure that model somehow.
Are you talking public or private or combo?
No, I'm trying to tap into like, what do you think? What are your ideas? I think it's probably a combo. I mean, I know that, like I was saying, the government in the US has made a number of statements, but I don't think that it has generated like it has in some other countries, funding action.
Yeah.
Maybe we're just early in those days. Maybe there should be a lot more of that. Maybe we need, I don't know what we need. I'm asking, what do you think?
Yeah, I think typically when there is a government mandate, you know, money follows, I think is what we found. We found it with, the Obama administration with electronic health records. We found it, you know, privacy and security a little bit. There hasn't been much on the federal side. But, you know, once the, you know, the U.S. government starts putting out security directives and then they release, you know, grant opportunities for an open tech fund, and they said that they would only fund 4 projects. Well, geez, I have 30 projects, and that's just right. Me, you know. Yeah. So we have a long ways to go. I also participated in OECD, Organization of Economic Development, event in Korea this year on cybersecurity. So it's essentially the German sovereign tech fund leaders of many countries. I found there's not a lot of international coordination. There's still folks, you know, like the sovereign tech fund leaders like Fiona and others who really have to be pretty scrappy to do pilots and sell up through the government. Then, of course, then the administration changes and then what? So we do have a long ways to go. And, you know, I think with privacy, the Choice Point data breach was really the eye opener. And everyone's like, oh, my gosh, privacy is important. We should do something. I don't know if we've had that, like, do we need a crisis? I don't want a crisis on my watch for sure.
Yeah. We've had enough crises, really. I feel like it would be nice if we could learn without one, but there isn't the thought of let's commit to this for 20 years. Like, let's commit our company, our organization, our government, or whatever to support this thing for a generation. You know, the best you can get is usually the, you know, however long the current government lasts, or whoever was the champion at a given organization retires or leaves for another job or whatever. And it's frustrating.
This is the nice segue for Brian to talk about standards, right? Mm. And how we're planning for 500 years ahead.
I mean, that is very interesting to me, because we talk a lot on this show. Like, this show will go into our web ecosystem health series, which is how is all of it funded is tricky and changing. W3C recently, only in the past, I think, 2 or 3 years, became a legal entity itself and is a 501c3. I'm really curious. Time has not passed long enough yet for us to know if, like, that will impact people's ability or willingness to donate money. But yeah, like, the thing that makes it all possible today in terms of implementations is ultimately Google default search money. And that's probably going to get disrupted here pretty quickly. And then what, you know? We're still early in standards even, you know. We only have been doing standards as something that humans are trying to solve as a thing for about 100 years. Before that, there were standards, but they were just, you know, de facto. They were just like, you know, Roman roads are this big because we said, do it. But I just think, like, we're still learning. We don't know what we're doing, and we're definitely not planning sustainably for the long run yet. They're really important standards, you know? I mean, they're the foundation of everything at this point. I mean, the call that we're doing right now, recording this podcast, is using a ton of web standards implemented in, I don't know what browser you both are using, but it doesn't matter. It will work in any of them, you know? But then at the end of the day, at some point, you start making a lot of money. It would be great if you would help pay for the roads and bridges that make all this possible. You know, that's the part we got to work on somehow. I would love to hear what ideas are banging around about, like, how you make it for profit. Because you can see from the way that we fund all this that there are plenty of ways. There's so much money being generated. You barely need to tap into any of it, really. These are huge numbers we're talking about, but, you know, when the population is billions and billions of people and money is floating all over the planet to pay for everything, it's not that much money, really.
I always like to say, you know, we don't like to pick winners or losers with open source projects, but I mean, I bet my career on coming to a foundation. And I think a lot of companies are sort of betting their technology choices on foundation hosted projects. You know, where do you invest your future? If, you know, would you invest it in an open source project being hosted by a company that may or may not be around in the future, or would you do it at a neutral organization? So I'm kind of hoping that at least sort of makes a dent, you know, in where people invest.
Hopefully.
Yeah.
But you're asking sort of what for-profit models. So some of the things, you know, the mud on the wall that people have been kicking around, there's a couple of things. Like, people, again, I said they'll kind of want to come and they'll want to buy a feature. Let's just say that. And we'll say, if it's important to you, come work on it. But, you know, some folks from big companies have told our sustainability collaboration space, you know, we'd probably pay for that. They probably won't let me work on it as part of my day job, but we might just pay for that. So that's an idea.
This is another tricky thing, because mm-hmm. It suffers from the first thing that you talked about, which is like shiny feature. More people would be willing to pay to implement shiny feature, you know? Mm-hmm. But then shiny feature has a maintenance cost, and the maintenance cost is really boring, right?
Yep.
And when we think about maintenance costs, like, it can be, I don't know, it's tricky. Like, I have a website that I could leave for 10 years and it's probably okay. Like, it's just a website. It's built on standards, so there's no problem. But, like, all of the things that make it possible, the web browser, the operating system, all those things, like, they're constantly evolving. They have, like, security vulnerabilities that people are trying to patch, and operating systems are updating. If you do nothing they bit rot, they become less secure, they, right? And so to keep those updated, you need lots of boring stuff. You need CI infrastructure, you need testing, you need, you know, people doing security releases, you know, maintaining all that boring infrastructure.
Yep, that's a big part of my budget for next year is the infrastructure.
And, you know, so I think it's, you know, it's like I say, it suffers from that problem that you said earlier that nobody wants to pay for kind of the boring stuff. They don't think about the boring stuff. But also the comparison that you made for government grants, right? It's like you can get a grant to get the new program, but then you have a program and they don't want to continue funding it, you know, so.
And that's where the pickle we got in, I think, with Sovereign Tech Fund. So to maintain the infrastructure that we've just migrated requires $200,000. You know, it's, you have to have people on call all the time and it's just the operational costs, which is actually not bad, but you know, that's $200,000. So
yeah,
like a big, for me, a silver member ranges from $5,000 a year to $25,000 a year. So those are primarily a lot of new members. So I have to sell a lot of silver memberships.
Yeah.
Yeah.
No, but this is actually a really difficult thing to even gauge, you know, like it's one thing to, you know, sit on this side and criticize, you know, but also if I were to put myself on the other side, it's hard because like we are a little bit on the other side, right? Like, so we have Wolvik as a web browser that we make and, you know, we can't get enough investment to do any real upstream work. Like we barely are keeping that going, you know? So, you know, at what point do you become responsible? Because if we honestly, if somebody was like, here's $5 million more dollars, we would be like, great, because we can definitely spend $5 million on Wolvik. I mean, easily.
Yeah, or Servo.
Yeah, that's what I'm saying, right? Like, yeah. Well, with Servo, it's easier because you are putting it directly into the engine. You know, like it is
right.
The roads and bridges you're investing in there. But, you know, with Wolvik, you're investing in the interface and the product that is painting the stuff onto the screen, but not the engine, you know?
True.
But yeah, I'm saying like that stuff at the top also costs money and you also want it to be a good product and you also have to make it competitive and you also have to do all the boring stuff. Like you have to keep up the security releases and, you know, like how do we figure out this arrangement, which I think we need to figure out where like you can do good things, you can create, you can innovate, you can do all the stuff that we love about open source, right? I mean, like you can do personal projects, you can do, there's so many things that you can do without having to go and get investment. But then at some point, like how do we make this arrangement so that at some point you're like, yeah, but now you kind of have to pay, right? you have to contribute back. Like there is no agreement like that. And I don't know. I've thrown around that maybe we should have like some kind of non-binding covenant that we promote that like, hey, look, it's not binding, but we're just going to kind of publicly shame you if you don't do it.
Yeah, we're joking, like everyone should have an LLC and then they should be able to say, you know, but some of our top maintainers do have service companies. And when someone says, hey, you know, they basically treat our maintainers like their own personal help desk, right? Hey, this is broken, fix this. And we're like, no, this is open source. This is how it works. But, you know, if you, I have a separate company. If you want to pay me, we'll do it. And then it's crickets, right? Nothing.
Totally. Totally. I mean, Egalia is a service consulting company. And so we're totally familiar with that concept.
Yeah. You know, on the flip side with security, I always like to say we're good at turning money into security and we have hired engineers to work on security and also add to their plate that they need to grow the ecosystem. So for example, Node.js did not even have a working or an active security working group. And then we got an Alpha Omega grant 3 years ago. We've gotten it 3 years in a row. And they've just now, they've just like doubled the output. They created processes and policies. They have half the churn. Now they have a really thriving security working group. So there are some success stories, but that was a paid person whose, you know, full-time job was to make it happen.
Yeah, it's just, it's so discouraging because it, obviously it's a huge scale problem. Like when you put up numbers that say, if we funded every one of the maintainers, that's $26 billion. Like immediately everyone just goes, well, they can't be fixed. And at the same time, that would be a bargain at the global level, sort of at a holistic level. That would be a huge bargain for what it would yield. And I don't have to tell you how hard it is to convince people that they should contribute to solving this problem. It almost does feel like somebody's national power grid is going to have to go down because, you know, the XKCD comic, the open source maintainer, stopped working on the thing that holds up the entire national power grid. And then maybe that nation will start investing. And then does that just have to happen for like every country to start getting those investments and every company? That's so frustrating and disheartening.
What's wild to think about to me is that like we live in such an age of subscription services at this point. Like, you know, you have, do you have Netflix? Do you have Hulu? Do you have Amazon Prime? Do you have Disney Plus? Do you have, you know, Max, Apple TV? Like one of those services costs me $10 or $20 a month. You know, if like everybody who has streaming services threw $10 or $20 a month into a pot, that would be so much money. And what I'm saying is the reason I'm saying that is because the fact that whole products exist to help you find ones that you don't even know you have, probably we could afford to do it is what I'm saying. It's not going to drive anybody into serious financial hardship. That's what we need to do. Let's make an open source project that is the thing that scans to make sure that you don't have accidental things. And it says, hey, how about just one of those you donate to like the Linux Foundation or something, right?
Well, and I sort of joke, I spent my whole life kind of rocking the proprietary software boat at Microsoft. So, for, you know, free and open source. So, it's a slippery slope, you know?
Yeah.
Yeah.
I think it's worked out pretty well for Microsoft at the end of the day. I think open source isn't hurting them too much.
No, the cloud is a wonderful thing, right?
Yeah. Okay. I had just pulled out of the notes a thing that I wanted to throw in there a while back, but you had mentioned the Obama administration allocated some money for the adoption of electronic health records.
$36 billion.
$36 billion. What's that one number?
I'm just curious. $36 billion over what span of time?
It passed in 2009, the High Tech Act. Like a couple of years, two or three years earlier, I think EHRs were in doctors' offices perhaps like at 10%. I think when it passed and was starting to be implemented in 2009, they were about 44%. And just a couple of years later, they went up to almost 90%.
Wow.
So $36 billion to raise that number over a couple of years. So we can even say over 3 years, you know, because they hit 90% in 2 years. But even if it were, if it's over 5 years, that's still about around $7 billion a year. And that's, that would be nice to have that kind of investment just sort of in the open source ecosystem long term. Like
that's
one country.
Yeah.
Yeah. That, and it, I mean, granted, one of the most affluent countries, the country with one of the largest economies in the world. But if that one country could do, let's just say $5 billion a year for 25 years, and you could get the European Union to kick in another $5 billion a year for 25 years, and then a few other countries, and you're starting to get close to that $26 billion that you were talking about to pay all the maintainers, which is, granted, not necessarily what you would do with that money. It would probably be invested in other ways, but you could at least, I mean, rather than trying to say, we'll pay you $43,000 to work on this, but if you could say $20,000 a year for 10 hours a week or $10,000 a year for 5 hours a week, or, you know, and I'm not even doing the math in my head. I'm just saying, you know, here's this amount that means that you're not, you know, having to give up all this free labor. Well, you're being paid for it in some way. And that would help the underserved populations that you talked about earlier, women and marginalized communities and people who are, you know, not in $250,000 a year engineering job or whatever, to be able to say, yes, I can actually donate some of my time to this. And some of those people could be project manager types, right? Not just the developers, but people who are doing the release notes so that the developers don't have to do it.
One of the things that I feel is related with standards that I should have probably said is that, you know, in the process of growing, we've included like lots of different people, and they initially, at least, were talking a lot in theory and also like in terms of how we relate to these things. Like, are they just a bunch of disjointed things, or are they all part of like a web browser or whatever? And one of the things that I see is that there is a lot that happens in standards organizations that is like aspirational, I guess. And that's fine. But one of the things that happened with the creation of the What Working Group is like, yeah, but if you don't have the browsers, then, I mean, it's just aspirational. I mean, there's not anything wrong with it being aspirational. It's just you need a way to ultimately fund it. And, you know, one of the things I've been thinking and pitching for a while is that, like, those working groups should have a common pool that they pay into, that then, given their magic pile of money, that's not so magic because they just paid into it, at the end of the year, they can prioritize that, you know. And that, I think, is the way that like some of the technical steering committees work and things like that. What do you think about that as an idea, like that when we make these things, like somehow rooting it in the concrete of how are we going to pay for it is helpful and it helps keep it grounded?
You know, I think it goes back to when you're talking about having magic piles of money within open governance, and, you know, it's, and how do you prioritize the spend? That's something that we're thinking about as well. And there's been some best practices. There's also some pitfalls we talk about. There's a big difference between paying for pizza and paying for people.
Hmm. Yeah.
So, you know, very easy to pay for pizza, but when you start paying for people, it gets very complicated. And you really, sometimes you can't do that with all of the other business, you know, and legal pieces around you. So
very much. Yeah.
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 So it's more complicated than it seems. And that's why sometimes sitting, again, if it was just a working group with some developers, that becomes a little more complicated. But having a fiscal host, so to speak, like a foundation or another entity, helps provide all of the other essentially compliance pieces that you need.
If we did have big funds like this too, then you need governance, you know? Like, I mean, one of the things with like Linux Foundation, OpenJS, like there's a lot of things around like governance, there's a lot of thought around that. And yeah, I mean, if there was a really giant fund, if you had a big pool of money, there's definitely questions about like what's fair? Not just fair, like what's, I don't want to say right, because maybe there's not a right. It's a challenging problem.
Yeah, it's. I mean, governance is key. And, you know, I've developed these grants with the projects. And I think the Node project and even jQuery before that really set, you know, kind of a North Star with governance, and it really does work. It's amazing. And so working on grants and spending money with the technical steering committees and open governance has worked as well. I think, you know, the more money that comes, I think there will be challenges. I know folks worry, like, will it be fair? How do you reward one working group over another? You know, so, boy, I like to do this in my own time. I don't like having expectations on delivering certain things at certain times. So that sort of makes, you know, brings some discomfort, I think, with the idea of money.
Yeah, totally. And I think part of the challenge is for us to figure it out. Like I say, I think we just haven't Well, I think we just haven't figured some of this stuff out as a species yet. I think we will. We need more time to explore it. And it's exciting to see the things that are happening because nothing is radically altered anything yet. But I think you mentioned like grants, you had a like pretty significant overall increase, right?
Mm-hmm.
Given the grants. So that's great. Is there anything else that you would like to tell us about?
Well, I think, you know, again, as a species, we do have that sustainability collaboration space. We are totally like throwing mud against the wall right now. So all ideas are good ideas. That's kind of where we are. We were even just sort of working on the time and we've had a few people show up, but you know, I'm very comfortable pushing the edges of comfort. We have, I always think the best lawyers, like we have some of the best lawyers. They're our business partners. They want to help us succeed. And then I have this wonderful community with the Linux Foundation. I'm part of the leadership team where we joke, we shamelessly rip each other off. They're my great cohort. We meet biweekly. So if anyone has any idea and you participate in any of these foundations, bring it to us because we are totally open and cool because we know how important this is and the work that's being done.
And how would people bring it to you?
For us, we have a public calendar and a public open invite on our Slack channel. So we have a sustainability channel on our Slack. And our calendar, you just need to go to the homepage of the OpenJS website. That's openjsf.org. You'll see the little calendar icon, and then you'll find our meetings. So all under sustainability. And final thoughts, if you have a magic pile of money sitting in your organization, hit me up.
Yeah, or even if it's not magic.
If it's real, yeah. Our membership, at different levels, sponsoring events, very deeply appreciative. And I would say we balance our budget every month. We know where every dollar goes. We're quite diligent about that.
Yeah. All right. Thanks.
Yeah.
Okay.
All right.
All right.